Coming up on Tech News Today, Apple wants to be made in the USA, Google Plus is killing it, and Microsoft Surface may be getting killed. All that and more coming up.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today for Thursday, December 6th, 2012. Tech News Today is brought to you by Squarespace, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website, blog, or online portfolio. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to squarespace.com and use offer code TNT12. And they recently launched a developer platform for complete code control. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Aya Zaktar.
And I'm Jason Howell.
We're doing a crossover event with this man right here, Ewan Rankin. He's going to join us for the discussion stories, and then right after the show, we're going to go all the way to England via Skype to do the big show on the British Tech Network. But let's start with the top 10 stories of the day in the news fuse. Apple CEO Tim Cook intends to bring manufacturing of one of Apple's existing Mac lines back to the United States. In interviews with Bloomberg Businessweek and NBC's Brian Williams, Cook touted the importance of bringing something more than just product assembly back to the U.S. Coincidentally, Foxconn, makers of many of Apple's products, announced today that they plan to expand operations in North America as well.
Google wants you to get more social within Google+. The company introduced Google Communities today so that Google+ users can connect with people with something called similar interests. Crazy idea. You can create or join a private or public community. Google says this is a preview and more a mobile version is coming soon.
ABC News reports John McAfee was arrested in Guatemala for entering the country illegally and will be deported back to Belize. McAfee had hoped to gain asylum in Guatemala. He's wanted for questioning in Belize in connection with the murder of his neighbor Greg Fall on November 10th. Investigators in Belize have said McAfee is not a suspect, but McAfee does not believe them.
Android photo lovers rejoice. Snapseed is finally in the Google Play Store. The app made by Nick Software is a robust photo editing app with an emphasis on gesture controls and ease of use. Snapseed doesn't have a built-in social network, but it shares really easily with Twitter, Facebook, Google+, and it's free.
Apple and Samsung's $1 billion patent battle rises from the ashes today in San Jose federal court. Lucy Koh must think this is a zombie. Samsung's trying to get the verdicts against it overturned. As part of the case, Apple had to reveal a little of the settlement it made with HTC a few weeks ago. Most of the document is blacked out, but among the visible tidbits, both companies will receive non-exclusive access to each other's patents. None of Apple's design patents are involved, and HTC is forbidden from cloning an Apple device. Pricing and royalty rates, however, were redacted.
There's some fine striking out. Lots of great Sharpie action there. NASA and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration have given the world a video showing the Earth rotating at night in greater detail than ever before. Now get this. The video is made up of images collected by the Suomi NPP satellite and was shot over 22 days. It took the satellite 312 orbits to get a clear shot of every part of the Earth at night. There are no clouds in the video. Those images were stitched together and overlaid on existing imagery of Earth to produce an animation. Still images are also available at NASA's site.
The Wall Street Journal reports the FBI is after hackers who targeted Admiral Mike Mullen, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The computers were personal PCs Mullen used on the grounds of the U.S. Naval Academy since his 2011 retirement.
The World Conference on International Telecommunications had a setback earlier today when reading materials were inaccessible after its website was forced offline for 2 hours. The International Telecommunications Union hacker groups have claimed responsibility for the attack, apparently in response to the approval of a new standard for deep packet inspection by the World Telecommunication Standardization Assembly. The standard has been criticized by groups such as the Center for Democracy and Technology.
Looks like T-Mobile users will be able to get the iPhone from T-Mobile sometime in 2013. Deutsche Telekom said Thursday that T-Mobile USA has entered into an agreement with Apple to bring products to market together next year. T-Mobile has been upgrading its network to 3G and hopes to start rolling out LTE sometime next year.
Rumors of the desktop PC's death have been greatly exaggerated. Intel told Maximum PC that Intel is committed to the desktop enthusiast market, and the company will be offering socketed CPUs for the foreseeable future. Reports circulated that future Intel processors would have to be soldered onto the motherboard. In other processor news, yesterday, AMD told Legit Reviews that it's all for sockets, at least until 2014.
This episode of Tech News Today brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website, blog, or online portfolio. Squarespace gives you and your website users the best mobile experience. We're talking all the time on the show these days about cell phones. We're talking all the time on the show about ways that people access things more and more on tablets, on phones, on small laptops. You got a website. You want to make sure that it looks right there, but also still looks right when they're at their desktop, because people haven't stopped using computers as much as you hear all this post-PC era talk. Squarespace has developed new templates with mobile-ready responsive designs, which means your site automatically restructures to look great on any brand, smartphone, tablet, or computer. When you add an image to your site, you don't have to worry like, oh, wait, is this one going to be too big for the phone? 7 different versions are created on upload so that the correct size loads for the device and your site looks professionally designed no matter how it's viewed. Beautiful templates, 100% drag and drop functionality for all your customization tools, and those designs resize. They fit in whatever device someone's looking at your site in. Squarespace has an award-winning design team and user experience experts. So if you get a Squarespace site, you can say, well, you know, my award-winning design team created it, when people compliment you on it. Squarespace integrates all your website needs, domains, design, development, hosting, and customer support all in one service. But you don't have to take any of those words that I just said for it. Go to squarespace.com, sign up for a free account. You don't need a credit card to try it out. Start building your website. Then if you decide to purchase it, use offer code TNT12. Because it's December, and get 10% off your first purchase on new accounts. Whether you do a monthly or an annual plan, you'll get 10% off that first purchase. That's Squarespace.com. Use the offer code TNT12. Everything you need to create an exceptional website at Squarespace.com. And we thank them for their support of Tech News Today. All right, let's bring in Ewan Rankin, editor of British Tech Network at BritishTechNetwork.com. How's it going, Ewan?
It's good, mate. You?
Good. How is the rest of today? Because it's evening where you are.
The rest of the day is going to be us shooting the breeze over tech with your show, and then you're going to come and shoot the breeze with us over our show.
So I'm looking forward to that. We're going to be on the
whole
big show.
Over. Yeah, it's going
to
be great.
If folks listening to this one later realize, oh, wait a minute, how do I get that? You go to BritishTechNetwork.com. If they are watching live, how do they watch the big show live?
You go to BritishTechNetwork.com/live, and then we're an IRC chat client just the same as you guys, and it's hashtag British Tech Network on IRC.geekshed.net.
Easy enough. All right, well, let's get started then with this made in the USA stuff. Good to have a Brit on the show to give us a little outside perspectives, and we were going to get all jingoistic in here. Brian Williams has that interview on NBC tonight on, what is it, Rock Central, I think,
yes,
is the name of that show.
10
o'clock p.m. on NBC. Cook told him, we will do one of our existing Mac lines in the U.S. Now, separately, Cook also spoke to Bloomberg Businessweek and said they're going to spend $100 million to bring some of that production to the United States. He said that doesn't mean Apple is going to do it ourselves, but we'll be working with people and we'll be investing our money. So it's more than just final assembly. It's more than just that assembled in the U.S. kind of stamp that we heard about earlier this week. Do you think it's a good sign that Apple does this, or is it just kind of pandering, like, oh, well, we'll bring one line over because that won't cost us too much, and then we can tout the fact that we're bringing jobs back?
I mean, what I figure is Apple, this makes financial sense for Apple, right? That's the first thing. It's going to do good PR things, and there's going to be the ability for Tim Cook to go on Brian Williams' show or Bloomberg and say, we're bringing jobs in the United States. But Tim Cook's about dollars and cents. He's always been about that with supply chains. If it makes more sense for Apple to build these machines in the United States, especially just one line, it might be a test for future lines to come here, because that's been one of the biggest pushes, like it was in the whole election thing. Like, these companies aren't paying money to the U.S. They're manufacturing overseas. If they're actually manufacturing in the U.S., they have to pay some taxes over here. So it could help out the economy, but just a big test.
Ewan, what's the outsider perspective on this?
I think there's two things here. There's kind of the cynical view, and then there's the non-cynical view. And the non-cynical view in me says, well, one product line, that's a toe in the water. Let's see if it works. Let's see if we can make money doing this. You look at the Google Nexus Q, that was being made in the US, wasn't it? And that kind of never even saw the light of day. How much of that was production costs? I don't know. The negative kind of cynical side of me says Apple's got a lot of money sat in foreign banks. They need some of that money to come back into the US. And I wouldn't be surprised to hear that there's been a deal struck whereby there's a tax break for bringing back in as a subsidy for creation of jobs within the US. I mean, I live in the EU, and it's common practice to issue subsidies to companies. You know, Nissan, come and build your cars in the UK, and the UK government will foot the bill of £15 million towards your factory, et cetera, and so on. So I think there's possibly a bit of that within this, but who cares in the end result? If it's jobs for Americans, and that's what Americans want, good on them.
The other part of it is Foxconn spokesperson Louis Wu telling Bloomberg that Foxconn is looking at expanding operations in the U.S. That would make it easier for Apple if Foxconn were building some of these things here. Although Wu said that supply chain is one of the big challenges for U.S. expansion, adding that any manufacturing we take back to the U.S. needs to leverage high-value engineering talent there in comparison to the low-cost labor of China. And that's one of the things Tim Cook told Brian Williams in his interview was the problem with manufacturing in the U.S. is we've lost some of the experience and expertise of manufacturing that they have in China.
Somebody in the chat room mentioned where people pay a premium for made in the United States products. The thing is, Apple already has a pretty healthy profit margin on every piece of hardware it sells. It seems interesting to see if Tim Cook could kind of cut into that profit margin for a small line. What's not the most profitable for Apple? Maybe something like the Mac Pro, which gets refreshed once every 6 years, apparently. I don't know what their cycle is right now. So they could maybe use that because it's component. These are commodity parts at this point. It's a motherboard. It's an Intel chip. It's the graphics cards. It's everything you can just collect here anyway and see if that cut to the profit margin is too terrible for them or not.
Yeah. Part of me wonders, and maybe this is just ridiculous. Maybe this doesn't make any sense. But is it a good sign for the United States if it looks like it makes financial sense to make things in the United States again? In other words, does that you go to China because wages are low there? Does that mean that our wages are so stinking low in the U.S. that we can build things here?
Okay, just be the import tariffs and things, just getting
that balanced out.
Just trying to get it from China over here, because if U.S. is not, if Apple's not making a ton of products for China, like they're trying to do with the iPhone, it's trying to make products for the United States. Having it local, buy local, right? It's right around the corner. Get your local Apples from around the corner.
In terms of manufacturing, though, what does $100 million buy you? I would have thought probably not a great deal. You're not going to get an awful lot of change out of that by the time you've tooled up within a facility that you've built, unless there's a partner coming in with that, and that's where the Foxconn cart comes in.
Yeah.
And if Foxconn is an overseas investor coming in and providing American jobs, how they're not going to get subsidy from the State Department, I'm very surprised. So.
Yeah. Meanwhile, somebody that might be able to use a subsidy right now is Microsoft. So a lot of evaluation going on about the Surface. What's the latest?
Okay, so there's a brokerage firm in Boston called Detweiler Fenton. And they said in a research note that Microsoft is likely to sell 500,000 to 600,000 Surface RTs in the December quarter. Now, in a vacuum, that doesn't sound so bad. But the thing is, the reports are Microsoft wanted, they ordered 3 to 5 million Surface tablets to sell in the fourth quarter. So the estimates are 500,000 to 600,000 sales. In the note, it's, quote, lack of distribution is killing the product. The mixed reviews are causing problems, and the lack of retail exposure at Best Buy and others is severely depressing sales. Now, Microsoft only sells the Surface in its online store and its brick-and-mortar stores with 31 locations and 34 holiday kiosks in the U.S., and obviously their online component, like I said. I guess the question is, should Microsoft start distributing the Surface outside of its stores, or is this, like, the safe strategy for Microsoft to not tick off its OEM partners, Ewan? Do you think it's because they don't want to go, HP, don't freak out, because we just sell them in these tiny stores?
I don't know. I mean, the huge sales in consumer electronics come from recommendation. And, you know, who's recommending that the Surface is a good buy? I mean, everyone was buying iPads because all their friends said it was good. And I bought an iPad mini the other week in Regent Street, having gone into the store with a buddy who was going to buy a phone. And I'd got no intention of buying it, but I picked it up and I fell in love. And the Surface, there's been a couple of expo events for Microsoft partners and Microsoft developers that have seen the Surface. But here in the UK, there's no one at retail you can go and actually physically squeeze and hold one. So until people get their hands on this device, it's not going to sell like hotcakes. And I don't think it's going to sell particularly well. At 500,000 to 600,000, that's nothing in comparison to sales of things like the iPad or even maybe Galaxy's Note. You know, they need to get some product out there for people to get hands on.
But is that part of the deal? That's a, that was an interesting part of your question, Ayaz. Is Microsoft intentionally settling for lower sales by saying, look, we are restricting the supply chain on purpose because that's when we can go to our partners and say, okay, OEMs, if you were worried about this, look, there's plenty of room in the marketplace. We're not selling surfaces because they're bad. We're not selling them because you can't get them. And then the so that's your job is to fill in the gaps.
It seems like the Surface to me is like almost like the band frontman. It's one of the ones that are out there. You're not going to necessarily go pick that one because this is the premium product. It's Microsoft's. Look what we can do. But you know, distribution aside, I think the mixed reviews aspect is really the issue because some people don't think it's a good enough tablet. Some people think it's a terrible laptop. It goes back and forth. And the general consensus has been, what do you do with this versus all the other versions out there? Because the RT, of course, is running on ARM. It's the limited version of the Surface. I'm kind of curious if Microsoft's going to push its Pro in other lines, because that's the real thing that people understand.
Are they really bothered about the partners? I mean, if I was Microsoft, where else are the partners going to go? They're going to suddenly start loading Linux on the machines at sale, or are they going to start they're not going to put OS X on it? I mean, come on. There's just, you know, the hardcore Windows users are the hardcore Windows users. There's no way you're going to get one of them to ship over to a Linux. You know, the average Joe in the street is going to open up a brand new HP running Linux or, God forbid, WebOS and say, where do I start it? You know, it's bad enough that they've gone to the Metro interface with Windows. Now there's still people wondering how to switch the damn thing off. The Surface has got to be something that, I mean, you wouldn't go through the R&D of creating this product and then not try and sell it, surely.
Dell just came out with a stock Ubuntu laptop, and I'm using one right now, and I have to say, there's not much difference anymore. Mm. The gap is closing. I think you're right that it's probably not quite to the point where someone, a large maker like HP, would say, oh, well, we'll just fine. We'll just switch over to Linux. I don't think that's practical because of the brand identity of Windows. But it certainly could push them towards exploring that more seriously.
Yeah, as people use the browser more and more for everything, as long as you have that experience or you have an app store, whatever it is, I mean, that seems to be the hook because the Windows 8 learning curve is so huge. If you're going to make that switch and go, what is this? You might try it with any operating system at that point instead of trying to learn that.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit on a related note about Intel's future. They're kind of tied up in the success of Microsoft and Windows. They've been really trying hard to move into mobile, but it hasn't worked for them. Intel CEO Paul Otellini announced a month ago that he would be stepping down in May, and a lot of people have been banking on the fact that a new CEO could bring a fresh perspective to Intel and sort of shake things up there. Paul Otellini was speaking at the Sanford C. Bernstein conference yesterday and said that's not going to happen. The track record of internal versus external candidates in our industry shows pretty clearly you want to stay inside if you can. Now, he doesn't get to choose the successor, but he believes that it will be someone who is already in Intel. And he said he doesn't expect the strategy to change after he steps down. Now, he may be just trying to calm investors from worrying that Intel strategy could veer all over the place. But what do you guys think of this? The idea of Intel saying, look, we've seen what happened with HP. We've seen what happened with Yahoo when they brought in outside candidates. I'm not talking about Marissa Meyer right now, but previous candidates. Intel has done well by promoting from within. Paul Otellini was a 40-year veteran. He took over 7 years ago from Craig Barrett, who was, you know, he was there from the start. So, Ewan, do you think that's smart for Intel to be calming people at this time?
Yeah, I think it probably is. I mean, if you look at Microsoft's hired internally, whatever you think of Steve Ballmer, there's a plan there that is being implemented over the longer term, and that person's cultured in that plan. Tim Cook with Apple, and where you've had the huge changes of Yahoo bringing people in from the outside since Jerry Yang went, and Meg coming in to HP, again, where you've seen that switch from outside, these people coming with fresh ideas, and they tend to hit a bit of a culture wall, perhaps, of well, this is what we did before, and this seemed to work, so why do we want to change that all of a sudden? I think you lose your employees an awful lot. I've seen a company that I do a lot of work for at the moment, they've got a new MD who's come in from outside of the business, and instantly it's created a friction instantly within the business that was jogging along, making a good profit, fulfilling the customer's demands, you know, satisfying the quality versus profit and loss syndrome. And that's suddenly out of kilter, and then people are upset, and then the profit and loss goes down, and the quality of service goes down. I think there is a real good benefit to keeping within the model that you know, if you've got a model that works. If you've got a model that's not working, that's not expanding, a la BlackBerry, then perhaps, yes, go outside.
Yeah, and for Intel to take somebody from within and move them up, and that's just good for consistency as well. Like you were saying, Intel, they don't really have a problem, and they're doing quite well in the markets they're trying to do. They're doing that TikTok processor upgrade cycle. They're getting into mobile. They're doing all the right things so far.
Trying to get into mobile.
They are successfully in some Android phones at this point, which was, I thought, laughable 2 years ago that would be a possibility. But they are in some. So they're slowly making that push. And because like they withstood that whole AMD challenge years ago, and they've just been killing it. I mean, they're just doing so well. If they can handle the ARM, I guess, onslaught, that's what the next challenge is for the next CEO. And it looks like Intel's got plans for 5 or 6 years ahead of time anyway. So it makes a lot of sense to stay within Intel because it's working.
Now, I'm guessing none of us are experts on the internal politics of Intel, but here's some of the candidates that have been bandied about by analysts. Yeah, touted. David Perlmutter, Intel's chief product officer, Stacy Smith, the chief financial officer, and Thomas Kilroy, general manager of Intel's sales and marketing group. Now, without knowing a lot about the people per se, you can tell a lot about what these three strategies would be based on their roles, right? I would want Perlmutter. I actually know a little bit about him. He's a smart guy, and he's the guy in charge of product at Intel. And so he can carry on with all that stuff that Iaz is talking about. If you go with Kilroy, that means you're gonna focusing a little more on sales. You go with Stacy Smith, you're focusing on financial responsibility. Doesn't seem like CFOs lately have made great choices as CEOs, but then again, that doesn't mean that Stacy Smith wouldn't be a great CEO. Ewan, you got any thoughts on those three?
Yeah, I think CFOs are good captains in storms. If there's no storm and you've got calm waters, then you've got to be thinking about looking at it for expansion and rapid investment and movement towards new technologies and that kind of thing. And CFOs are notoriously bad for that kind of stuff. I think in this kind of market where you're looking to, you know, with Intel, have got a solid business, and then they're starting to think about, well, where do we go next? To go with a CFO, I think, would be a retrograde step. They've got to go with someone who's development or even sales oriented.
What do you think, Iaz?
I'm just thinking, like, I think Mercer Meyer was a products person, and Stephen Elop, when he moved to Nokia, he was the head of office. It's just kind of like, it's kind of curious, what would be the best? Is a products person the best? Maybe not necessarily, because they want to work on the product, not necessarily the whole strategy of the company. I would think, actually, Kilroy might be the best way to go, because he's doing the sales and marketing. You want that at the top, because you want your products guy to stay there as products, because that's what he does really well. And to kind of defocus him or move him away from that could be a problem in the future, but who am I to say anything about these three individuals?
I'm still for Perlmutter. You want that person who knows and believes in the product above all else and serves the customer's interest. But I like that we all came down with good reasons on all three. That's interesting. Let's move on to Google Plus Communities. New feature coming to Google Plus. Lots of numbers coming out about Google Plus's active users today. What's the deal, Iaz?
Okay, so we got the Google Plus Communities rolling out today. On the left side of Google Plus, you should see a circular icon. I still don't have it. I don't know when it's coming up. You can filter posts by topics or discussion categories. You can join and create private or public communities. Now, Google's official blog, they showed some examples.
You said circular thing. Oh, it's over there on the left.
The icon itself,
okay.
Yes.
All right. Yeah, I don't have it either yet.
Yeah, it's a little green icon. And so I'm waiting on it so I can join a community, be part of some of the example ones that Google talked about already. There's a photo community by Trey Ratcliffe, a Star Wars community, a maker hacker community by Adafruit. So some really good, you know, starring roles with the beginning of the communities. In the same post announcing communities, Google also announced some numbers. They were kind of squirrely about how they talked about it. Google announced it has 235 million, quote, active across Google, parentheses, plus wanting apps in Google Play, Hangout, and Gmail, et cetera, and 135 million active in the Google Plus stream. So it seems like they're kind of, what's the word? They're segmenting out the numbers slightly.
Spinning
the 200. If you plus one anything in the Google Play store, they think that's active members.
Although, to be fair, Facebook does the same sort of thing with likes and sort of that sort of thing when they report their numbers.
I guess with the new community feature, though, Ewan, is this going to make you hang out on Google Plus more? Because I know when I started using Google Plus, you have these large circles. They don't necessarily have the same interest. Like, I know when I want to talk about putting together a machine, I think this hacker community is a good idea. When I want to talk about photography, should be in the photography section, because otherwise I'm just getting kind of like noise back. Are you going to start using this?
Nope. I think the problem with Google Plus is it didn't look at the model that Facebook had got in terms of being a community. And in Facebook, I signed up as me, and then we created the fan page for Bagel Tech, as it was now British Tech, and it develops from that. And it was within that circle that developed. Whereas people now with Google Plus, because it didn't have that element to begin with, they've gone in with a specialist Gmail account. So we're BritishTechNetwork@gmail.com, and we've already got a Google circle that's based around that. So if in terms of communities, what's that going to give us any more than we've already got? Not a lot, perhaps. I think this maybe will get like-minded people together if the community comes up for photography, like you say, or for specific interest groups. But in terms of business or existing group participation functions, they've kind of made the best of a bad job already with a specialist Gmail address that's then created its own circle.
Tom, what do you think about this latest spin on forums? It's effectively a forum.
Yeah, I think Bells in the chat room said it best. Community is interesting and cool, but I don't use Google Plus. And I do use Google Plus personally, but I think that's a lot of people's attitude. So I don't think rolling out community or some kind of, you know, Facebook groups type thing is a bad idea at all. Of course, it's almost a must-have feature. It's another box that you can tick off to say Google Plus now has more of the features you expect from a social network. I don't think this is the thing that wins people over to Google Plus or changes, you know, the momentum of Google Plus at all. And I don't even think Google thinks that. I think it's sort of like, yeah, they've got a great feature. They're going to tout it, of course. I think what helps Google Plus expand and win is the bottom up, the sort of invading the other parts of your life with search, Gmail, calendar, Docs, any of that stuff that you use. When Google Plus insinuates itself there and you sort of accidentally find yourself using it, that's when I feel like, aha, Google Plus is winning now, because I don't think they can take on a Facebook or even a Twitter head on. But that doesn't mean they shouldn't have these features for people who aren't coming new to Google Plus and want them.
Yeah, but back to that comment about somebody not being on Google Plus, the fact is there's 135 million people active, as this Google's claiming, and it's like for those people to find each other, because your friends might not be on it. Mm-hmm. It seems like the community might be like, hey, you guys are here. Maybe we should reward you a little bit. We'll find you. You guys can actually have friends who are on Google Plus, as opposed to going, my friends aren't on Google Plus, or I've made friends through Google Plus. Could be a totally different kind of way to go.
And see, that's the difference between us, because British Tech, we'd have Invading the Bottom Up as a show title already.
And there's the show title. You guys ready for a sad story? This is kind of a sad story. I hate to say it.
I'll steal up. Okay.
But yeah,
it's the upper lip.
Get the Kleenex. Patrick Klepek, A Giant Bomb, has a story of Alpha Colony. That's a DreamQuest Games effort at Kickstarter. How it fell $28 short. $28. Talk about a heartbreaker, just psychologically, when you fall that short. And it was the second attempt to fund the game. Their first run, they had wanted $500,000 because they were going to license Mule to use in the game. They fell quite short of that. They only raised $101,472. So they redid the effort. They said, we're not going to license Mule this time. We're just going to say inspired by it. That brings the cost way down. And they put their goal at $50,000, feeling like, hey, we raised $101,000 before. This is in the bank, right? Planned for stretch goals up to $300,000. And what happened is it didn't get as much attention as the first run. People started to worry that it wasn't going to get backed, and people started pulling out their bids. And a lot of people are like, you fell $28 short. Why didn't you just pledge $28 and push yourself over the line? And they said, we couldn't keep up with where it was at the end because so many people were pulling out their money. Now, you are not allowed to pull out your money from a Kickstarter that has met its goal in the last 24 hours. But any other kind of Kickstarter, you can pull your money out at any time. So in that last 24 hours, they were watching people just pull their money out. They were also seeing last-minute contributors trying to run to replace that money, but those folks ran out of time. The process of going through the motions to add your money caused them to run out of time before the Kickstarter ended. So a lot of suggestions are being bandied about. Folks have suggested an overtime policy. If a project is within a certain distance of its goal, that you get an extra 30 minutes or extensions be added. DreamQuest founder Christopher Williamson has said, look, we're not, this is Kickstarter's rules. We played by him. That's the breaks. We're not going to try to get Kickstarter to change it. And he's already heard from several individuals interested in making the game happen in other ways. But Ewan, what do you think? I mean, should Kickstarter adapt to this, or is this like, no, this is the arena you play in?
There's a certain element of this is Darwinian, isn't it? I mean, if your product's that good, then it should exceed your threshold fairly easily. If it's not transparent about how you're doing or where you should be, then, yeah, maybe there's a need for a tweak there. But I've got a real problem with games going through Kickstarter. Products I can understand because you've got R&D costs, you've got prototyping costs and patent costs. With Alpha Colony, I looked at it, and there's a fair amount of this game. Looks like it's almost a done deal. So why do you need 50 grand? I mean, it's easy enough to float this in the iOS store or in any of the other stores that are available, or to make a package that then goes into a local store. I don't see I personally don't believe that games are any kind of sound investment within Kickstarter anyway.
Yeah, the answer is they wanted to hire a programmer to do the port. They've done a lot of the work of the game, but they needed to hire one more programmer. Now, the interesting thing is, too, they needed $100,000 for this, but they only went with $50,000 because they thought they could get momentum out of meeting the goal and getting everybody excited, and it backfired on.
Well, and the other thing is, I mean, Kickstarter isn't the only platform for this. I mean, Brian Brushwood used an Indiegogo, and that gives you an option of, I believe it's called flexible funding, that you get to keep every bit, even if you don't fund entirely. You get to keep that money, and obviously Indiegogo takes a larger cut if you don't reach that funding goal. It's like 9% over 4%. That just means that while Kickstarter might be the darling and the big name that everybody knows, it might not be the best vehicle for these kinds of things, especially if you're like, oh man, $28 and I can't keep up. You might want to be able to go to an alternative, and I think Indiegogo might have been a better option, especially if you wanted to, if you really want to do this project at, like, not at all costs, but like you just want something to start off. I don't know if games are the best version of that or the best thing for that, but like Schwid's scam stuff, like there might be a reason to have a tiny bit so you can start a seed fund.
I think that that maybe what Kickstarter could do is say last 24 hours you can't change anything, no matter whether they've met the goal or not, because that seemed to be one of the frustrating things here, is trying to keep track of where they actually were, as people are like, I don't know, this doesn't look like it's good. I want to save that money for something else, because, you know, I guess there's a psychology to that which doesn't make sense. A lot of people are like, why would you pull your money out, you know, because you get your money back if it doesn't succeed,
right?
So why would you pull your money out at all? But I hope that Kickstarter does take this as sort of a an example to maybe tweak the rules. But great point, Ayaz. You can go somewhere else if you really want that kind of flexibility. Let's finish up with Amazon and Android developers.
Yeah, so Amazon's launched a new feature for App Store. They're calling it A-B testing for developers. Well, they're not calling it that. That's like what
it is.
What it is. It's A-B testing for developers. Excuse me. Developers will be able to upload multiple versions of their apps to the experiment. And unlike Apple's review process, you know, there's no review. You just put it up there. There's no Google publish immediately. It's just that people will be getting two different versions of the app. Developers had to use third-party services for A-B testing before. Now they can use Amazon's built-in testing. The release isn't terribly clear if Amazon's tools are going to allow any Android developer to A-B test, or if this is just going to be Amazon App Store at small. No, what am I trying to say here? Is this just going to be limited to the Amazon App Store, or will it be for Android in general? So I'm not sure if that's what's going on there.
It will be. I would guess, without them saying that, if they haven't said, that means it's limited to.
They've
the
suggested
Amazon App
both.
Store.
On the release and the website. So it's not clear at all. But it's probably limited to the Fire HD right now. Amazon's introduced a bunch of App Store features recently. Game Circle, a Maps API, Test Drive, which is try before you buy, a Kindle Fire emulator. And they said that their App Store downloads grew, quote, more than 500% over the previous year. And, of course, Amazon doesn't actually give numbers. They just give numbers like this. Is this feature set for developers? Is this going to keep sparking development for Amazon's App Store, or do you think this is just Amazon just trying to get developers over because they don't allow full on Google Play apps?
I think the thing with Amazon is they've now got this ability. They've got their walled garden is starting to be formed. It's, you know, the bricks and mortar starting to come up, and they've got to invest in allowing developers to give the developers the best opportunity to know that what they got as a product is then sellable, scalable, etc. So in a subsidized kind of way, they have to do this kind of thing to drag the developers in. And I cynically again, I would say that this is a subsidy that allows them to do that. positively, it's an enhancement of service that's going to give their end users a more positive experience. I think it's a necessity, but I think good luck to them, because I think Amazon have really invested well in Fire HD and their services to customers. They've kept the prices low. They're looking at the content as being the main driver for the income. It's their investment well done to them.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Amazon is doing badly in development. They don't need a huge spark.
He's got a space rocket fleet, dude. Come on.
Yeah. So I think this is just Amazon continuing to say, hey, we're trying to make it so that our system works great. We're rolling out more improvements. And A-B testing is a great one. Whether they allow it to be used for the wider Android universe or not.
Yeah, by the way, there is an update on the TechCrunch article. Amazon tells TechCrunch that A-B testing is for any developer making apps distributed through the Amazon App Store.
Right. So that would have been my assumption is that they can't, it would be too hard to try to plug this around somehow.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and that's kind of the point here, right? Is like taking their limited amount of devices, which is just the Kindle Fire, you can compare it directly in some ways to the Apple ecosystem, where, you know, those apps really only have to test on a few devices. That's all that Amazon cares about here. They want to make sure that anybody that's bought into their ecosystem with those Kindle Fire tablets gets a perfect experience with the apps that are distributed through their app store. So they have no interest in doing this for Google's Play Store. It doesn't make any sense for them to do that.
I do think it's interesting that you could use Amazon as your A-B testing and then go take your Android app and put it out in the Google Play Store.
Well, I guess, but what does that tell you? That tells you that your app runs on
Don't think about
hardware,
just running on hardware. Think about interface. Think about experience. Like, do people like it when we do in-app purchases more, or if we emphasize free stuff more? You know, there's all kinds of things you can learn that is device independent.
In which case, that could be even more incentive for developers to start tapping into the Amazon App Store even more, because it's just another kind of leg into their stuff.
That also means that as Amazon keeps building their ecosystem for its own developers, its own App Store, that they will probably never go full Android. We're always going to be stuck on Kindle with this, unless you root it or do something different.
Yeah. Let's move on to the randomizer. What will it spit out? Randomizer. Something crazy? Like dogs driving cars?
That's crazy, Tom.
Why, in fact, it is. Dogs driving cars down in New Zealand. Trainers in New Zealand have taught a dog to respond to commands that would allow it to drive a car. So they hooked up a special steering wheel. They taught the dogs to actually... it's not time for the calendar yet.
The dog did that.
Bad dog. So handbrake, accelerator, and a paw accelerator, and the steering wheel with a special thing on it to make it easy for the dog to move it back and forth. Now, the dog doesn't actually just watch the road. You have to give it the commands to turn left, turn right, brake, stop, etc. And then you see like treat reinforcement at one point in the video here, but.
And there's also some video of the training itself. It's like dogs on a car seat being pulled like on a wheelbarrow as the commands are being done. It's actually quite amusing. But then again, for everybody who complains and is freaked out about self-driving cars, you got something new to freak out about when you see a dog driving next to you on the highway. Well, I guess somebody's going to be running really fast, giving them commands next to them.
That's kind of my favorite part about this is how many times have you been driving and you look over and you see that dog like in the passenger for a split second, you know, the way that dog's perched up, you're like, is it? No, it's not. Now there's room to doubt.
The way that dog paw reached forward and grabbed the gear shift and pulled it back into gear, that was so staged. That looked like, was a fake
that's real.
Paw. No.
It's trained.
Not having it.
They can do banking, go to the refrigerator, and then they can drive.
You're not going to trust the dog to drive you home from the pub?
Does this mean, there's the chat room saying, Ken from Chicago, does this mean the dogs will chase their own cars?
In cars.
Just high-speed chases all the time.
They're going to jump in the car and head down the road. All right, let's check out the calendar.
Sure. Hey, look, it's time for the calendar, apparently. iPhone 5 is coming to South Korea and 50 more countries tomorrow, December 7th. Also tomorrow, China gets the iPad mini. The Nintendo Wii Mini launches tomorrow, December 7th, in Canada for $100. That's the one without internet connection or all kinds of GameCube compatibility. Facebook is also extending its time for voting on site governance to the 10th of December.
More time to vote on whether you should vote or not. That's what they're voting on. Let's see what's incoming.
Incoming message.
Got an email from Tom. just writing emails to myself. No, different Tom. He says, I'm a rural prepaid cell customer, and while I enjoy the freedom of having a cheap cell phone bill, I also suffer since I'm not on one of the big three. Truly, only one of the three works remotely well in my town, as the coverage is spotty and mobile data is very limited. Because of this, using an SMS replacement product is not a feasible option for me. Sure, I use Wi-Fi wherever I can, but even though I have line of sight to a cell tower, I get no data reception at my residence, and it does me no good when I'm out running errands and don't have access to Wi-Fi. SMS works great, however. There seems to be large swaths of areas where an SMS replacement would not work until rural broadband becomes more pervasive. So really what he's pointing out is SMS isn't going to die until data penetration reaches the same level as cellular penetration.
Because SMS messages are sent a lot. It's a different network. And it works. You don't need to have that awesome data connection to get that data out there.
Although as we go into LTE more and more, mm-hmm. the carriers are going to be carrying voice and probably text, if they mm-hmm. keep them around at all, over the same mm-hmm. connection the data goes. So sure. that problem will eventually go away. You have similar problems in the UK, right, Ewan?
Yeah, we always get that that statistic from the cell phone providers here that says 98% of the population's covered. Well, that's okay, because 98% is in probably about 20% of the physical space. And generally speaking, if you stick to the motorway, freeway corridors here in the UK and the big towns and cities, you get great coverage. At rural areas, I mean, I use Waze an awful lot, W-A-Z-E, and that's a fantastic navigation application, but it does require a data connection, and when it gets into certain towns and villages out in the sticks, it just drops off to nothing. And yeah, you'll get an SMS, but nothing else. It's getting less and less, but I mean, I think we haven't quite got the expanse to cover that you guys have. I mean, it's, you know, you're 50 times bigger than we are with only 5 times greater population, so it's easier here. It's a lot easier,
even worse than Australia, where they're spread out more.
Well, they really are centered in population zones only, you know.
Yeah. All right, well, that is it for this episode of Tech News Today. Like I said, we're going to be heading over to the big show at the British Tech Network. Ewan, tell folks all about that and anything else you got going on, man.
We've got about a dozen shows going on at the moment, and we're also up for the European Podcast Awards. We finished third last year with the Max show. So we've got 6 shows nominated. If you go over to BritishTechNetwork.com, you can vote there. And you don't have to be in the European Union to vote. You can vote from anywhere in the world. Just click on the British flag. Go to BritishTechNetwork.com and all the links to straight to the shows are there. Please, please, please vote for us, because we could win. And we should win, because the big show has got fantastic people on it, like Tom and Ayaz and Jason. At BritishTechNetwork.com/live.
You're not submitting that one as a... as an example.
No, we've already submitted the 3 that are in there, and it got last year. I think we might have won, apart from the fact one of them was a bit inappropriate, and well, there
that
you go.
That can go either way, right? You just never know. You don't know what the judges are going to think.
Well, best of luck with that. You've been on our shows, mate. You know that they're not really scripted.
No worries. Well, best of luck with the awards. If you'd like to find our appearance on the big show, check out BritishTechNetwork.com. If you'd like to submit a story for consideration, submit it to TechNewsToday.reddit.com. That helps us figure out what stories we cover each and every day. That's where we found the dog story, as a matter of fact. A bunch of guys were voting on that. And if you'd like to be on Tech News Today, a handful of lucky folks... We've got some ideas about bringing some of those subreddit Redditors on as well. But open mic submissions are open. We're going to record the show Monday, December 17th at 9 a.m. Pacific time. If that time works for you and you're available and interested, email tnt@twit.tv with the subject line Open Mic 2012 and let us know who you are, what you do, and why you'd like to take part. That's it for us. You can find us on twit.tv/TNT every minute of every day. You can also email us tnt@twit.tv and give us a call and leave us a voicemail. Our phone number is 260-TNT-SHOW. We'll be back tomorrow. Maybe Sarah Lane won't be at the Prime Minister's residence anymore, and she'll be back tomorrow. But Darren Kitchen will be here, too. We'll see you then.